now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Stuart Robson, George Culkin, and our qualified referee, Alison Rudd. Today we'll be discussing Sunderland's awesome display at Stamford Bridge and the draw between Aston Villa and Manchester United. I'll also be asking our panel, including George Culkin, who was a young, wealthy footballer at one time, whether we judge our successful stars a little too harshly. One place to start, and I guess it's the shock upset of the weekend. Chelsea going down 3-0 to Sunderland. I think, you know, going down, it really was, as one-sided a game as you're likely to see. And Peter Cech, who I've been critical of, actually made some very good saves, or the margin could have probably been even bigger. I think it's only fair, since we have George Culkin on the show, to start with the man in the Northeast. And George, I know you don't actually live in Sunderland, but you are pretty close by. Are there birds chirping, and does the Northeast seem like a brighter place this morning?
You have to say, looking at the league table this morning, it looks a very nice place, and fairly unusual as well, that you can see so many positives for both clubs at the moment up here. But remarkable story for Sunderland. They were absolutely brilliant yesterday, as you say, and to think that it's come, you know, 2 weeks after they got hammered at Newcastle is a fairly remarkable turnaround for Steve Bruce to have, you know, his worst day in management so closely followed by his best. But they were absolutely brilliant at Chelsea, and that performance at Newcastle aside, it's only one defeat in the last 10 games, and they've got a fantastic record against the top four.
I have to come out and eat some humble pie for now, although I kind of stand by what I said, but I thought 13 million in change for Asamoah Gyan was a little too much, given that, you know, 2 years ago I think he scored one goal in 16 games for Rennes. But obviously he's made, he was very good, he made the difference. He, as I heard from some fool on television, he's really enjoying his finishing, which seems absolutely demented to me. But what happens when Darren Bent comes back? Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe that Bent and John have actually started a match together this season, have they?
They haven't, no, but Bruce had gone on record in the week after the Newcastle game that he was going to play them both together. So Bent's injury didn't allow him to do that. So, I mean, I think the thinking for now is, having played 4-5-1 for much this season and looked solid, he was going to switch back to two up front. And a word for Danny Welbeck as well, who's been playing wide left for most of the season in that five-man midfield. He went up front at Chelsea, and I thought was absolutely brilliant. Guyan scored four goals in the last three games. It's been a source of sort of some debate amongst Sunderland fans how he's not been able to get into the team after paying all that money for him in the summer. But he certainly, the way he's playing at the moment, he certainly looks like a decent piece of business.
Stuart, Asamoah and Bent, a viable partnership?
Well, I'm not sure that. I think they've got the same attributes. I'm not sure they're going to link up. Neither of them are combination players. When I saw Sunderland earlier in the season, I thought Bent had a great understanding with Mel Bronk, who I thought was back to his best football. Mel Bronk playing just behind the main striker, with Welbeck on one side and Al Mohammadi on the other side. I thought it worked really well for them in many of the games that I saw. If you play Gyan up front, one of those players is going to have to be left out, and at the moment it looks like it could be Mel Bronk. But I thought he was the key to what Sunderland were doing earlier in the season.
Alison, I sometimes we get really cool, we see really neat things that even somebody who doesn't like football can relate to.
Who are those people?
I wouldn't know. But one of those things that unfortunately I didn't write into the script, although I should have, is Johan Elmander's goal. I don't want Bolton fans to get upset, but yes, we should all celebrate Johan Elmander. But back to this game, the other ridiculous PlayStation-type goal was Nedim Onuoha's goal, which... I mean, he's a bit of an unusual guy. He's supposedly very, very bright. He's studied. He's got all sorts of A-levels and doodads like that. And he also used to be a sprinter, I'm told, when he was 14 years old and so on. But to conjure up a goal like that was unbelievable.
Yeah, someone who didn't see it said, well, I heard there was a great goal. What was it like? And the first thing that popped into my head was, I said, oh, it was like John Barnes at the Maracana. It was that sort of, you know, you sort of have to blink a couple of times. Think, did I really see that? Because this is someone who, you know, it's one thing to say a team works very hard, as Sunderland did, and earn the right to get a good result, and they never let up. But you sort of the extra bit, the bit that is really unbelievable, is that I felt so confident they were able to express themselves to such a degree that they would score a deliriously gorgeous sachet in and out goal.
And this is from a player that Manchester City, when he was playing at right back or centre half, and when I've seen him play for England under 21s, I've always been critical because I thought he couldn't play out from the back. I didn't think he had the technical qualities. But on that occasion, it was a magnificent piece of skill, wasn't it?
George, you see this guy up close. I watched some of this on German television, and somebody said it was like Messi. Of course, Leo Messi could probably fit in Nedim Onuoha's butt cheek. Did you see this coming? Is this a season that Onuoha establishes himself as a regular for Sunderland and maybe a guy who can kick on with England as well?
Well, he's been you know, regular with them so far this season, has been very, very good. I would be lying to the nth degree if I said there's been any sign of that kind of goal or anything remotely similar to that. No, I mean he's proved very capable at the back. You know, Sunderland's back four has been sort of one of their big improvements this season. But no, I've not seen anything like that. On the subject of Sunderland goals, I would urge people to go on YouTube and put in Boudewijn Zenden dance just to see his version of the Asamoah Gyan chicken dance after his goal, because if there's a definition of dad dance on video anywhere, that's it. It's a truly heroic performance from him.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that on the highlights package. It looks like Gyan does his thing, and then Bolo comes up and starts doing it for a few seconds, and I think must realize that he looks absolutely ridiculous and stops. But Bolo Zenden, of course, one of the good guys in football, and I believe a black belt in judo as well, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Well, I'm not going to have a go at him about his dance in that case. But in future, he should stick to holding his pint glass on the side of the dance floor, as far as I'm concerned.
But to be fair, nobody looks good doing the chicken dance, whether they're 16 or 34. So,
you think anybody looks good?
No, nobody does. So,
what about George Clooney?
Nobody was doing the chicken dance.
Okay, all right, just checking. We probably should talk about the double winning champions as well. They were absolutely turgid. Now, if you want to talk about all the injuries they had, for the record, you know, you've got Alex out, you've got John Terry out, you've got Michael Essien, who of course is the whole freaking show, out, you've got Frank Lampard out, you've got Yossi Benayou now, you've got Didier Drogba with malaria, but you still expect more of a performance, right, sir?
Absolutely. And the problem is, I've been saying for a few weeks, I think they've been quite complacent. They've won games without playing particularly well. And they think, well, if we get in trouble, we'll just raise the tempo again. We'll take it up to the next notch. The problem is, they can't now take it up to the next notch. And I don't think, when all those players are out and the players that have come in, I think they're all good individual players. But I don't think there's any fluency in what they're doing, particularly defensively. Some of the defensive decisions they made yesterday and the positions they took up was really, really poor. You know, and it made it much much easier for Sunderland to break them down. Yes, Sunderland played well, but some of the counter-attacking was so easy because the decisions that Ferreira made, the decisions that Ivanovic made, and the midfield players, there was no real protection in midfield with Zirkov and Morales and Mikel didn't look up as though he was up to full pace. It was a real problem for Chelsea at the moment, and they've got to get back on the training field and start working at the defensive side of the game as well.
Yeah, half their spine was missing, and I think that obviously would affect any clubs, but I think you have to point your finger at the manager and say, well, you have a problem, players are injured, what do you do about it, who do you draft in? And to have Ivanovic and Ferreira at centre-back was stupid. I don't understand the logic for that. They looked uncomfortable from the word go, and they became increasingly uncomfortable as the afternoon wore on.
But Ivanovic,
but why would you have four? I think it's happened before. The managers have put four fullbacks along the back. Never works.
Because
he's seeing what week on week in that. Between them, they've got pace and they look good, and he likes his fullbacks because they're whatever. They're in form, they're looking fit. But it's a very different position being a centre half. He's got Bruma, hasn't he? Why doesn't he play him?
Well, because Bruma's coming off an injury and couldn't last 90 minutes.
But
he's
a centre half and has all that goes with that positional sense, etc.
He doesn't last 90 minutes. I mean, I agree that the Paulo Ferreira was obviously a bad decision. Ivanovic, I have no problem with. In fact, I think his best position.
Yeah.
I think he's a central defender, Ivanovic, actually, more than a right back. But Paulo Ferreira, clearly, when you factor in his age, you know, he's a reserve right back, third choice right back when Bissouma was fit. It was a bit of a disaster, but then I asked myself, what could he have done in terms of, you know, who else could he have played there? And short of putting Obi Mikel there and maybe starting Mikel.
I'm not sure
midfield.
He could have put too many other players there, but what he needed to do, having known that this was going to be his side, they needed to work as a back four throughout the week, you know, and the midfield players working alongside them. You need to have some sort of strategy when you're going into games defensively. Yeah. And it didn't look to me, I think he felt, well, these players would be good enough to beat Sunderland, you know, we'll do the things we normally do. And they hadn't worked hard enough in training with that back four because they were all over the place at times.
And he took a gamble that Terry would be fit. Terry had a nerve problem all week, and it went, whatever the nerve problem is, it went on the Saturday, so that's probably why they didn't work on it. But I mean, again, there was an indication that there might be a need to reshuffle his defence, and I think you're right, Stuart, he didn't take it seriously enough.
No.
Anybody want to suggest that Ray Wilkins' departure was to blame for this turgid performance?
Well, Ray Wilkins is a lovely chap, but I don't think he had any influence whatsoever on the training field and around the around what the tactics were. I think he was just a nice guy who sort of was the link between the players and the manager. But do you need people like that? You can get paid £400,000 a year. Lovely bloke, but I'm not sure what sort of job he did at Chelsea.
Wilkins was there when they lost at Anfield, wasn't he? So it's not like suddenly they lose for the first time ever.
George, all those talk about Chelsea's problems and Ancelotti's mistake, does it take some of the gloss away from Sunderland to you?
No, I mean, I think that's to be expected. You know, they're playing at the home of the champions, aren't they? As you said, and their result there will have to be put into that sort of prism. But I don't think anybody would deny that they didn't deserve not just to win, but to win very comfortably. And you know, I hope that people do sort of take a step back and look at Sunderland's record this season against the top sides, and they'll see that it's not, you know, it's not a one-off. They've had probably until Craig Gordon came back into the team in goal, they've had the youngest 1-11 in the Premier League this season. So it's an interesting story what's happening there. And you know, Steve Bruce has done very well to turn it around, particularly after that Newcastle game.
Moving on to Villa Park, we've seen this before, you know, Villa 2-goal lead, United come storming back. But I want to start with Barry Bannon and Mark Albrighton. Now, we discussed Mark Albrighton earlier this season with Alison Rudd, and I have to say, I not recall the exact quote, but Alison said something like, oh, it's one game, I mean, come on. Now, these guys were at the club together with Kieran Clark and Nathan D'Alfonso, who I believe didn't start a single league game under Martin O'Neill. Now, all of a sudden, they're playing. Now, is this a case of Martin O'Neill not trusting young players, or is it a case of Houllier's genius in identifying that, hey, these kids can actually play a little? Stuart.
Well, I've seen these players play many times for Aston Villa Reserves, and you'll ask me what I'm doing at Aston Villa Reserves so many times, but I do go and watch a lot of reserve team football for some of the work I do. And these have always been, Aston Villa have been at the top of the reserve team league for many years now, and Kevin McDonald's done a fantastic job. And this was one of the arguments that the board and the people underneath Martin O'Neill had with Martin O'Neill. He wasn't giving the youngster the chance. Yes, they've been brought in because there's been a lot more injuries, but Bannon has been a good player in that central midfielder. He's a great passer of the ball. I don't think he's the most athletic of players, but he certainly is going to open up defences, as he showed the other day. And Albrighton was Villa's best reserve team player for 2 or 3 years, and he deserved his chance. And when he has come into the side, he's played very well. Delfonso, I'm not quite so sure about him. I've seen him play well, and I've also seen him be a little bit lazy at times, and I'm not sure he's going to fulfil his potential. And I'm not sure about Kieran Clarke, but certainly Bannon and Albrighton are stars of the future.
Alison, you want to revisit your opinion of Mark Albrighton?
Whatever I said was probably eminently sensible at the time. You can't judge a player on his one appearance in the Premier League. And if he's gone on and he's proving that he can cope, then that's fantastic. But it's a combination, isn't it? A combination of that Julio's been forced to look at the academy players because he's got injuries. If O'Neill had had his hand forced, maybe he would have done the same thing. Also, they're a year older now, and if they're coming through together... And you can, I mean, in a way, if there's more of them going into the first team at the same time, it helps because they have an understanding. And if they've been playing really well, as Stuart says, in the academy together, then, you know, that's what it's supposed to be. This shouldn't be a big surprise.
Aston Villa spend an absolute fortune on their academy, you know, and that's what I think Randy Lerner's been saying. We spend a fortune on this academy. We are producing players, and so Kevin McDonald tells us from the youth team and the reserves, but they're never being played in the first team under Martin O'Neill. Is this the right way to? Yet you're buying players that you don't play either. You know, you think of Shorey and some of the other players that he bought. Bay that he never played, and I think that was the criticism of Martin O'Neill, and that's why you're seeing some of the younger players coming through, because I think it's something that's coming from the top, and the people below Julio have said these players are good enough, put them in the side.
I was just going to say that you know, I don't think people would have predicted that Stephen Ireland would start the season so poorly. I mean, that's been one thing at Villa, and that's given people a chance. Just to briefly return to Sunderland, you look at how Jordan Henderson emerged last season. I don't think anybody expected, I mean, Steve Bruce included, expected him to come in and sort of and take it by the scruff of the neck the way he did, and now he's in the England squad. There's sometimes, you know, a mix of circumstances, and you don't really find out about these players until you put them in.
You're quite right there, because
at that level.
Because I was speaking to Liam Brady, the Arsenal Academy director, and he's sometimes a little bit miffed with Arsene Wenger, because you give a young player a chance and he has two bad games and you never see him again. You know, the first team coach said, he's not good enough. You know, we'll have to go and buy somebody. But you go and buy somebody, you might give them 10, 15 chances, because now you've got them at the club, you have to play them. So youngsters have got to almost come in and be brilliant, otherwise they never get another chance.
Well, it's probably also because when you buy somebody, you've invested money and effort into it, and certainly the first team coach has done so, whereas if it's a kid or if it's a guy from the reserves, you know, you can send him back to the reserves and whatever else. And what I do find interesting is this ability to turn to the kids. Is that also maybe a sign of, if a manager plays the kids, he's not going to get criticized, he's not going to get stick from the fans, is he?
Not so much. I mean, the fans at Aston Villa are desperate for young kids to come through. That was their criticism of Martin O'Neill. And I saw the very first game of the season at West Ham, and Kevin McDonald was put in charge. He put two or three of the kids in, Albrighton being one of them, and there was a different atmosphere towards the players. They want the young players to do well. You can't play a whole load of them, you know, because in the end, you're only going to produce one or two really good players from your academy every couple of years. But Albrighton and Bannon are the ones.
But it is worth bringing them through in batches, isn't it? Oh. Because at Fulham the other week, Bannon played one of those sort of telepathic crossfield
passes
to Albright, and you could tell they'd played, you know, these weren't two people just come in and it's the Premiership, oh isn't it exciting, they've been playing together for years, and you could tell. So it does make sense to have batches of academy boys coming through together.
So I just have to correct you there, just getting word through here on my cans. It's not the Premiership, it's the Barclays Premier League, and I invite you all to use the correct terminology. Premiership was just a marketing tool back when it was a Carling Premiership. It's the Barclays Premier League. BPL, if you like.
But lyrically, it just sounds nice, doesn't it?
George, I thought Villa created a billion chances. I thought they could have scored three or four goals. What's interesting about United, and I mean, we've seen them, you know, make bizarre comebacks. What struck me was, at one point, he takes off Berbatov and Hernandez in one fell swoop. It's kind of rare that you see sort of a front striking partnership come off at the same time, isn't it?
Yes, it's very strange. I mean, particularly when the two people coming on are Obertan and Macedo. I mean, you know, people talking about Hernandez a week or so ago, a couple of weeks ago, as the, you know, as the natural heir at Man United, and Berbatov obviously started the season pretty well. We've seen these comebacks happen before so many times, but sort of again, sort of relating it to Chelsea, you have to ask, whether Chelsea have had the stuffing knocked out of them even by the fact that the teams below them just aren't, just aren't pushing them. I wonder if that's part of why Chelsea sort of have taken their eye off the ball a little bit, because although Man United haven't lost this season, they've drawn a heck of a lot of games. You know, Arsenal lost at home to Newcastle. Man City have, you know, are certainly in a bit of a rut. I just wonder whether there's that, the teams at the top are sort of being pushed enough.
That's an interesting point, because of course this is the weekend where, you know, of the top four, as we said, Arsenal the only one to win. And is this the worst United side right now in terms of the players who are actually available that in sort of the last 4 or 5 years?
I would say yes, looking at the way they've been playing this season, although they haven't lost. I've been to many of their games, and on Saturday it was lacklustre. The central midfield partnership of Fletcher, you expect to bomb forward and make things happen, and Carrick didn't really pass the ball particularly well. Park on one side, you know, he's not dynamic enough.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Enough to go past people. Nani had a terrible game. I think Warnock kept him in his pocket.
By the way, Nani's not fit.
No, he can't.
He's clearly carrying it. This is what really concerns me about Fergie is Nani's clearly not fit, and yet he still plays him, which he generally doesn't do. He generally doesn't play players unless, you know, it's a Champions League final.
Because he hasn't got too many other people. But
he's got nobody.
Well, now Obertan has started to come to the fore. When Obertan came on, I couldn't believe that he went and played behind Makeda. That was the strange thing that he said. Berbatov wasn't playing particularly well. I think Alex Ferguson didn't think he could get back into the game. He took those two players off almost as if to say, you haven't been playing well enough, I'm going to make an example of you, I'm going to take you off, because I could see Ferguson on the side of it. He was absolutely furious with what was going on the pitch, and he put these two youngsters on. Go on, you go and see what you can do. And Makeda played well, of course, but Obertan in the role behind the main striker, he's a right winger. I've seen him play for Bordeaux, I've seen him play for Manchester United reserves, I've seen him play for the French under 21s, always on a right as a right sided midfielder. He went and played in the role just behind Makeda, and he picked up the ball. He showed good pace. He went past, but he could have actually won the game for Manchester United when he went past the defender. I think it was Collins to get the shot in at the end. So it was a strange decision that he made to put them on, but it worked for him in the end.
Can't we just call it brilliant then?
What, Sir Alex?
Yeah,
brilliant. George, you're impartial here. Is it Sir Alex is brilliant in orchestrating this comeback, or was he actually not that brilliant? He's actually got a bit of a problem with his team, and he's maybe a bit lucky that Makeda and Obertan were able to turn it around.
Well, I think it's a bit of, you know, I think it's a bit of both. They still have that sort of aura when it comes towards the last 5 minutes of a game, that, you know, there's still a feeling that they'll sort of pull something out of it. But I think increasingly it feels a bit more like desperation than anything else. If you look at Man U's bench at the weekend, you know, it just looks desperately weak. And I think there was a strong feeling that they're ready for a sort of big refresh in the summer. I think they have to be.
One other point, a refereeing point, so we turn to our qualified referee here. Ashley Young, who by the way, I've been really impressed with this season. They score the goal, he goes to celebrate with the fans, and he gets booked. Nemanja Vidic goes and does it, and he doesn't get booked. Now, the explanation which came through on television is that the referee, rather than announcing it in a press conference afterwards, goes and feels the need to go and say it to the TV company that holds the rights, but that's a whole other issue. He says, well, Vidic was pushed into the crowd. Vidic went to celebrate near the fans, but then he was pushed into the crowd by his teammates, and that's why he wasn't booked. This is all just stupid, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not the referee's fault. I mean, they have to work under these ridiculous parameters about inciting problems in the crowd. But I mean, they need to look at it, doesn't it?
George, should we just introduce a bit of fun back in football and allow all this jazz with the shirts coming off and people celebrating with the fans? Would that be really just a terrible thing?
Fancy dress. I mean, let's do that as well. Dress down Saturdays. How about that? Play football in jeans.
Why not? I mean, I don't know. I just think the trouble here is that it looks as if there's one rule for Vidic and another rule for Ashley Young.
What they should ban is synchronised celebrations. They should be banned, and anybody doing that should be sent off, not even booked, just sent
synchronized
off. Synchronised celebration. Right. Should be sent off. It's pathetic.
Yeah, well, our debate this week is actually prompted by something George Culkin wrote about his time when... he was a Newcastle footballer in all but actually playing football. George, I urge everybody to go online behind the paywall and read George's piece, because it's... I'll sum it up, George, and you can basically correct me if it's wrong. But young George Culkin came of age in Newcastle at a time when there was a tremendous openness about the club, and because he was roughly the same age as some of the players, and he started frequenting some of them on a social basis, and basically was introduced to the world of what it's like to be a footballer in Newcastle, out on the town, on the big market, I guess, or wherever it is you guys go. George, would you say this is pretty much an accurate reflection?
Yeah, no, that's a very kind of view, but that's about right. That's about right, yeah.
And what did you find?
Well, that it's a very beguiling experience. It's a sensory overload. It's difficult to explain. I mean, you have to put it into some context about what Newcastle's like as a city, which, you know, we don't have too much heavy industry anymore, but there's still that tradition of working hard through the week, and then the weekend is all about football and going out and letting off steam. And so there is, you know, there is that kind of correlation between socialising and football. And if you're a footballer and you go to a club or a bar in town, you walk into that place and you're immediately being stared at by everybody, by everybody there. If the place is empty, it's within 5 minutes, it's full. People want to buy you drinks. Women want to come and talk to you. Blokes either want to shake your hand, or, you know, there's a darker side of it as well, and that's that they want to, you know, to challenge you. But and obviously this kind of whole thing is very much in the news at the moment because of Andy Carroll. But if you're a 20 something year old guy, you've got some money in your pocket, and you come from the area, I wasn't really trying to make sort of any sort of great sort of moral point or sort of any great point at all, except that it must be very difficult to resist that temptation, because I've seen it at close hand, and it's a fairly remarkable experience.
Stuart, you were a young footballer once, mm-hmm. But in sort of a different set of circumstances, perhaps, because you're in London, where, you know, even if you're a very famous footballer, there's probably somebody more famous than you in the same bar most of the time. Can you relate to the stuff George describes, or was your experience much different?
Well, I got in Arsenal's first team at 17, but I lived in sort of Southend at the time, so I didn't go out in London. I went out in Southend. But my rule for most of my career was that I never did anything that would jeopardise my career. So most of the problems that footballers have today are drink-related. You know, if you go out for a meal, you don't get a problem. But as soon as you go out to a club and you start getting drunk, that's when all the problems start. I've seen it when I was at West Ham. I did have a year where I used to go out on a Saturday night after games and went out with some of the other footballers. And it was always drink that was the problem. until they'd had a drink, until they'd got drunk, there was nobody having a go at them. There was nobody. They weren't trying to do the wrong things with different women. It's when drink got inside them. And that's the problem. Why do players want to drink? Because it doesn't do them any good. When they go to training on the Sunday or when they go to training on the Monday, they can't perform at their best. And if you're a professional footballer and you're being paid an absolute fortune, you, for your own benefit, you want to do the best you can every day in training and every day you go onto the field. And that's the, that's what you have to do, I think.
Why don't clubs have a zero tolerance policy on alcohol during the season?
Well, I would if I was the manager of a Premier League club, I'd have a zero tolerance on drink because I think it's the one thing that causes all the problems.
And it's so easy to police because you can test very easily whether you've got alcohol in your blood. You can see evidence of drunken behaviour very easily.
Presumably, anyway.
I mean, so many managers use really quite sophisticated statistics to monitor how many minutes on the pitch they're going to give their players. And you sometimes see a player hauled off on 74 minutes and you think, why have they done that? They were playing really well. And it's and the manager said, well, I knew he had 74 minutes in it because I've been monitoring him for the past 5 weeks. And I know exactly,
Sam Allardyce,
right? Well, there are a lot. I mean, Benitez is famous for just not looking at the bigger picture, just looking at his stats. And so if you know your player that well statistically, then alcohol's the one thing, something or any impurity, anything that the player's been either eating or snorting or injecting or imbibing, you know that must really affect your stats. So how you can have all this sophisticated equipment and application to how you're going to conduct the
you're
game
exactly
and
right.
then allow them to go out on a binge on a Saturday night is
George,
ridiculous.
You can't stop people from drinking. There's nothing illegal about alcohol. You can encourage them to do that, but I honestly don't know how you can.
Of course you can, because pilots are not allowed to fly planes if they've had a drink. There are many careers where if you've had anything to drink, you're not allowed anywhere near your job.
In football, they can say
within 24 hours they're not allowed to drink, and you know clubs have the same policy within 48, 72.
Football clubs can say you can't ride a motorcycle. They say you can't
go and
ski, and you can't do these things. I think they should say you can't drink either, because you're actually damaging all the training you're doing. You're damaging it by having drink.
George, you can see how much fun it is to be in the studio here with Rudd and Robson and the rest of the moralizing prohibitionists.
Have a drink, relax.
But I wanted to ask you because I was it a slightly similar situation to yours in terms of I frequented one footballer who was a friend of my cousin's, actually, and this guy didn't drink. He just stayed up all night and then went to training and then slept all afternoon. And it was just the way he was. It seems
what,
to me...
So what was he doing?
Well, basically he would wake up around 10 o'clock at night and go out and, you know, would do a lot of things and basically come back and go straight to training, and people tried to talk to him, and he was sometimes fell asleep at odd times, and he liked to sleep, and that's what he did. And he said the guy really hardly ever drank. So is it really that much about alcohol, or is it also about being able to get away with things?
I think it's a bit of a bit of both. I mean, certainly when I was out with sort of, it was one Newcastle player in particular, who was a very good friend of mine. He was clever enough to do it at the right time. Most of the time, certainly. I mean, you know, he was clever enough to sort of assimilate lessons when, you know, he wouldn't do it before games. It would always be if there was a week between matches, and we, you know, have one night out and a blowout. And you know, certainly in terms of his career, he didn't suffer from that too much. But you know, you look at someone like Joey Barton, who again has been in the news recently, and you know, I was desperately sorry when Newcastle signed him, because I thought that after the sort of all the kind of the problem players they'd had there before, he was the last person they should be signing. However, and obviously subsequently he got into a huge amount of trouble. However, since then, for 2 years he hasn't drunk. He's reached the decision that alcohol affects part of his character, which I think we saw on the pitch the other night when he punched Pedersen. Now, on the pitch, he can't do very much about that sort of instant reaction he has, but off it, he certainly can influence it, and the way he's influenced it is by deciding not to drink. Now, clearly what's going on in Andy Carroll's social life at the moment is feels fairly unsustainable, and you would like to think that he'll reach a decision somewhere along the line about either being more careful, more clever, or just getting himself out of the firing line completely.
To what degree are there issues with somebody's own background? I mean, beyond what they do, sort of as young 20-something young men. But I mean, in Andy Carroll's case, and I should probably be a bit careful here what I say because I've only heard third-hand rumors, and George, I'm sure, can set us straight. But I mean, this is a situation where, you know, his Range Rover gets torched.
Yeah.
Where I come from, that means something. I mean, sometimes you have to make allowances for the fact that, or, you know, you mentioned Joey Barton there. We all know who Joey Barton's brother is and what he's done. Do we have to make allowances for the fact that, you know, you can take two kids, you know, two academy kids at 18 and somebody's got an absolutely sterling supportive background and the other one, you know, comes from the wrong side of the track?
And that's why you've got to, the clubs have got to do more about it. If they've got a young player that's an exceptional talent, but this comes from a rougher background or has got problems socially, then the club need to look after him. They need to make sure that that's not happening. I think that's what Sir Alex Ferguson has done over the years. That's what all the young players that have come through Manchester United's academy say, that he knows exactly what they're doing. He keeps them under a tight rein. I'm not sure that happens at other clubs, because sometimes the managers encourage people to drink. I've been at football clubs where the managers encourage you to actually drink, you know, because it's good for you, loosen off, and you know, and one of the managers that I played under, he couldn't turn up for pre-season training when we went to a training camp for 3 days because he was drunk.
Damn, I was hoping at some point that George would tell us about the time he swam across the River Wear, presumably on a drunken night out, but no such luck, right, George?
I was out with a footballer. I'd actually just separated from my wife at the time. He took me out to commiserate with me, had a boozy meal, went back to Durham, carried on drinking, went to have a look at the cathedral at my request, stuffed with miniature bottles of whiskey in my pocket, decided I wanted to have a look at the river, fell in, swam across, threw my shirt in. Wow. I don't want to go any further to that. It was a very, very, very stupid thing to do, and lucky to have got to the other side, both of the story and the river.
Goodness, but it's not one of those sort of polluted, yucky English rivers, is it? I mean, relative to others?
I have to say, my memory of the actual level of pollution of the river is not what it could be. In fact, I'm not going to tell the end of the story, but it's certainly, I mean, that really isn't something to be proud of. That was a very, very stupid thing to have done. And I mean, I told it, I suppose, to illustrate the fact that it's not just footballers who can get themselves into trouble. Because at the end of that night, my footballer mate went back, watched Coronation Street, had a cup of tea, and was fine. And it was me that couldn't, it was me that couldn't handle the drink.
Yes, clearly, football writers are greater degenerates than footballers. Now, how about some quick hits? I won't even dignify my producer Chris calling them off the fence anymore, because this is completely demented and makes no sense. Jay Bothroyd has played a grand total of 0 minutes of Premier League football since April 22nd, 2006, which is, believe, is as many minutes of Premier League football as you've played, Stuart.
Exactly.
Is the Cardiff strikers call up a sign that there isn't much depth among English strikers, or is it a sign that Fabio Capello has now had a screw come loose?
I think it's the first one. There is a dearth of English strikers that can be called world class. You look at all the strikers that are playing up front for England, they could all do the same sort of job. They're all similar style of players. We haven't got any great players at the moment in front areas. That's the problem with English football. We're not developing players as we should be.
Wayne Rooney thanks you, by the way.
Well.
Speaking of English strikers, Andy Carroll played 90 minutes in Newcastle's scoreless draw with Fulham on Saturday. But he's 21, he's athletic, he's scored 7 league goals already this season. George, what's the percentage chance that Carroll will be England's starting centre forward at the 2014 World Cup, and why?
I think he surprised everybody with his rapid progress. He scored lots of goals in the Championship last season. I didn't think he would step it up to the level that he has done, but he's been brilliant so far. And he offers something very, very different to most of the other strikers around. He's dominant in the air, but he's also mobile. You look at the way previous England managers and players have thought about someone like.
Sorry, George.
We've gone out of time.
Yes. Okay. But you can have another 5 seconds. Just give me that percentage chance as well.
53.2 recurring.
53.2 recurring. Thank you, George. There was plenty of debate about whether Saturday's defeat to Stoke was, in fact, Liverpool's worst performance of the season. Alison, there are plenty of candidates. Where does it rank in the scales of futility?
It's pretty high. Probably the worst because the victory over Chelsea was great. Great spirit, great organisation, great tactics, stars came to the fore. And then what happens? A drab draw against Wigan, and then a defeat which had no spirit whatsoever, and the boo started again. So in terms of the overall context, yes. Gab, here's one for you. Inter fell to AC Milan 1-0 in the Milan derby on Sunday night. Are the knives out for Rafa?
No, they're not really. Not from the club. He's not going to get sacked because, having spent so much money to go and win the Champions League, now it's kind of like it's this whole sort of post-coital moment for the club where they don't. I really don't think the owners really care as long as Rafa doesn't embarrass them. He did have a lot of injuries. AC Milan played very, very well. Surprised many people, including me, but there's no question that Rafa needs to get his stuff together because he's had a stinker.
And proof that it all comes back down to sex with your post-coital comment.
No, but you know what I mean. Like Inter Milan won the Champions League. They've been chasing this for so many years since 1965. This year, like they're like, oh look, we won. All right, Jose's gone. Let's get Rafa in. We need a new manager. Let's not give him any money to spend. It'll be fine. And who really cares? And look, we're still champions of Europe. And that's the whole attitude at the club this year. Like they really couldn't. You get the sense that they could care less.
That should have been 10 seconds ago.
Great.
Thank you, George. Thanks for joining me. Now you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your gossip, your analysis. Our web chats, I do mine on Mondays. Ollie Kays is on Wednesdays. Graham Spears does one during the week as well if you're into Scottish football. And if you like your Ashes, you can also check out our Ashes Preview podcast with Mike Atherton and the outstanding Christopher Martin Jenkins. It's on the site and it's on iTunes now.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.